It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Fred, good evening. Just minutes ago, Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz fired Imran Awan, a Pakistani-born IT technician who has worked with several family members to perform computer services for Wasserman Schultz and other leading Democratic lawmakers. Awan was arraigned on one count of bank fraud charges in U.S. District Court here in Washington today, following his arrest last night at Dulles International Airport prior to boarding an overseas flight. He pleaded not guilty and was released under strict monitoring. Awan's started working for Wasserman Schultz in 2005. She, of course, was forced to resign as chair of the Democratic National Committee 1 year ago after WikiLeaks began posting her hacked emails online. In all the daily caller reports that Awan, his brothers, their wives, and others collected, at least $4 million for IT services performed for Democratic lawmakers. In addition to Wasserman Schultz, these included Diana DeGette of Colorado, chair of an investigation subcommittee, Jackie Speier of California, who sits on the Intelligence Committee, and Ted Deutsch, ranking Democrat on the House Ethics Committee. The investigation started with allegations that the Awan Group was engaged in double billing, but then reportedly expanded to include how sensitive House data was stored. The group was barred from House computer networks in February when Capitol Police identified them as suspects in a criminal investigation. In announcing today's firing, Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz said, and I quote, "Mr. Awan previously served as a part-time employee, but his services have been terminated. No charges, evidence, or findings from the investigation have been formally shared with our office, so we cannot comment on them." The Daily Caller has reported that authorities seized smashed computer drives from Awan's residence. Charging documents released today, however, do not explicitly link this bank fraud charge to the House IT case.
That was James Rosen 2 years ago. This is Sandy Rios this morning, and that's probably one of the most untold scandals, serious scandals that took place in the United States House of Representatives in my lifetime for certain. And it was chronicled by a reporter named Luke Rosiak, who writes for the Daily Caller in a book called Obstruction of Justice, How the Deep State Risks National Security to Protect the Democrats. And Luke and I have talked about this book. We've talked about this situation time and time again, and it's available, by the way, if you want to read the story. It's amazing. But Luke continues to write about what's happening on Capitol Hill, behind the scenes. He does great research, and I've asked him to join us this morning because he's been covering a number of other issues that you might not have seen or heard about on the nightly news. As I said, Luke is the author of Obstruction of Justice. He's also an investigative reporter for the Daily Caller, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning, Sandy. Great to be with you.
You know, I would really like to know, first off, if there has been anything further on that Awan case, those brothers that so defrauded the Senate, the House of Representatives, and took all that information. Has there been any follow-up, anything else develop on that story since we last spoke?
No, I mean, the story is really one of cover-up and astonishing corruption at the Department of Justice. I mean, the FBI agents stood out front of his wife's apartment so she couldn't go to court and tell the judge that he had threatened to kill her and was blackmailing her. I mean, it's just banana republic level corruption. So I don't expect anything to happen. I don't expect these guys to face any punishment. And that's kind of the whole point. And, you know, we've learned a lot about the DOJ. And like you said, the Imran Awan case is kind of the flip side of the Russia investigation. And the Russia case, you have them concocting charges against Donald Trump. And then with the Imran Awan thing, you have this astonishing true story of international meddling and collusion. And, you know, basically the DOJ is well aware of it and covered it up. So it's truly disturbing stuff.
Hey, look, I want to, before we move on, and we are going to, I heard it behind closed doors, speculation from people close to this story before you even told it publicly, that there was suspicion that it was actually the Ilwana brothers who had potentially leaked the DNC email, or at least had access to it and were careless with it. Do you have any feeling about that, or impression about whether that might actually be the case? And could that explain why the FBI was so diligent not to let this story break?
Well, I think that people were very concerned about the impression that he would have stolen them at a minimum. And so I think the timing of it, Imran Awan was first caught by the House Inspector General hacking the House the same week that the DNC was hacked. So it would have absolutely been perceived that way. And we know the Democrats were very deliberately concocting this Russian narrative. And so I think that that was 100% the driving force, is don't let this distract from Russia. As for whether he actually may have stolen them, I mean, in my book, we do reveal that he was going to the DNC offices like on an almost daily basis when he didn't work there. So that really either Wasserman Schultz was using taxpayer-funded money to have him volunteer under the table at the DNC to save costs, which would be illegal, or he had some other reason for going there. But it's, yeah, that's a possibility.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the Mueller report. And, okay, just some nuts and bolts things here. I want to say that the Daily Caller was founded by Tucker Carlson a number of years ago, and I also want to just say personally, I love Tucker Carlson. There's no one on the air who packs more of a punch with more a measured, effective response, approach, and also offense to the left than Tucker. And I met Tucker when I used to host Crossfire. Sometimes I filled in for Tucker. I used to be a guest a lot, and then I filled in for him a few times. And so we go back a very long way, and Daily Caller kind of was his brainchild, and it has grown into really a force to be reckoned with. And when I bring the news every morning, there's hardly a day, I'm not sure there is a day, when I don't use information from the Daily Caller, because their reporters, like Luke, have become really a powerhouse. And the other thing is, I know it's trustworthy information. And with that in mind, Luke, I'm just curious to know, because I've known from your reporting how careful you are, but what are the standards for the Daily Caller for what can go to print and what can't, and how you vet it?
It's a really great question, because people would be surprised. I mean, I worked at the Washington Post prior to the Daily Caller, and the Daily Caller standards are absolutely higher than the Washington Post, at least in my experience. It's very meticulous. It's very cautious. You know, of course, we've got an opinion side and then a news side, but the investigative team is very diligent, and the standards are incredibly high. So, you know, I think that some people who really don't read the Daily Caller have a certain idea about it, but that's actually not borne out. I'm tremendously proud to be part of it, and I think it really punches above its weight. My colleague Chuck Ross has been really one of the main people who knew about everything around the Mueller report. He got it right from day one. And, you know, he really put the New York Times and the Washington Post to shame, and I think they're probably embarrassed, and they should be, because they've got so many more resources, and yet they bungled the story, and he didn't.
Well, I think the truth is, Luke, that their reporters sit behind their computer, you know, and Google and look on their Twitter feed, and that's how they write their stories. You guys do boots on the ground. I remember I was so impressed when you told me the research you did to write about the Awan brothers, how you sent people to their home country to be on the ground to actually find out information about them. You guys really researched that, and I want to underscore that. Because I can't say enough about the journalistic standards of the Daily Caller, and also to commend to those of you listening their website. So, Luke, you did at least, I know that you guys have to have assignments, or you'd be writing about the same things all the time. But on the Mueller report, that was Chuck's main beat, as you just said, Chuck Ross. But you came out with a story just this, well, let's see, I guess it wasn't this week, but it was last week, and it made me laugh. I didn't think there was anything about the Mueller report that could make you laugh, but I would like for you to tell us this story about what you found out about Michael Cohen and the Russian wrestler.
Yeah, I think that you're right. There's definitely some comedy buried in that 450-page report, and it comes down to basically the hilarious incompetence of Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. And so at one point, Michael Cohen inadvertently colludes with a Russian politico because he thinks he's someone else, and because he Googles him wrong. And so he gets this email, Ivanka Trump gets this email from some Russian, and she doesn't know who it is. So she says, Michael Cohen, you're a lawyer, you're involved in this whole business about trying to build a Trump Tower in Russia. Should I talk to this guy? And he Googles him, but he Googles it wrong, and he gets the wrong guy. And he says, oh, yeah, Ivanka, he's a weightlifter. That would be cool. Let's talk to him. He was in the Olympics. He's really good at lifting weights. And so for like 6 months, Michael Cohen is talking to this guy, and he's like, hey, do you want to meet with Putin? Do you want to meet with Putin? And Michael Cohen the whole time just thinks, oh, I'm just talking to an Olympian. This is really cool. I'm talking to an athlete. And so, you know, he advises Ivanka Trump that this is fine. We should just keep talking to this guy. And eventually, you know, he basically never figures it out. The whole time he thinks he's talking to this weightlifter. And then he actually does later on, basically the weightlifter, the quote weightlifter, loses faith in Michael Cohen. It's like, whatever, no one trusts you. You don't even have the ear of the Trump organization. I'm going to talk to someone else. So Cohen is kind of spurned, and he says, all right, well, I've got my own contacts in Russia, but which was basically nothing. He just like had some guy that he knew that he thought had a hookup and didn't. So finally, Michael Cohen's efforts to contact Russia literally come down to him going onto the website of Russia and saying, who's the press contact? And emailing just like the generic email box where you would email to the press department for Russia. And not only that, Michael Cohen spells that email wrong. And so when he tries to collude with Russia, Michael Cohen is just sent lobbing an email into a public inbox, and instead of .gov at the end, he writes .gov, D-O-F, so the email doesn't even go through. It's just so many levels of hilarious incompetence.
Well, so here's a couple of points. I guess I'll make the profound one first. Michael Cohen is Donald Trump's one of his attorneys. And the allegation is that they're trying to do business in Russia, and the Russians, I think, if I understand it, wanted to use the Trump brand to build a hotel. And so they were so my question to you, Luke, from your experience and your knowledge, is there anything immoral, illegal, or fattening about the Trump organization doing that?
No, and it's very clear in the report. I mean, the idea, they're like, oh my God, they documented 400 pages of contact between Russians and Trump. Like, yeah, that was what they were looking into. Is they were assessing each interaction, and of course, they itemized them in the report. But it's really innocuous and kind of boring when you read it. Like, the reasons they're interacting with these people are, in most cases, pretty clear. And in the stuff I just mentioned, it's just as you said. I mean, they needed to get approval from Russia to do this deal. And so Michael Cohen was just trying to do his job and get this deal sealed. It had nothing to do with politics. It's just kind of funny that this is what the whole country has been obsessing about for 2 years in this such a nefarious way. It's just like kind of the goofball incompetence of this this crazy lawyer just like failing to, you know, conduct some business maneuvers ever in Russia.
There's nothing
nefarious about it. It's just dumb.
It is, and it's really funny. And even that they would include it in the report and confess that they were going after something that is so silly. I can't even believe they wasted time in their document laying this thing out, because it makes Michael Cohen look ridiculous, and it really makes them look ridiculous as well. So at least we found one funny spot. Now, you also, earlier in the month of April, wrote a piece about what you had discovered about the FISA motion that allowed the FBI to share American citizens' information with foreign agencies. We're going to talk about that on the other side of the break, because that's very important to what happened in this Mueller probe. And you're the one that wrote about it, Luke. So my guest is Luke Roziak. Again, he's an investigative reporter for the Daily Caller. We have a lot of interesting things to share with you, so stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
AM
The intern for Houston Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee is facing charges this afternoon. He is accused of stealing and posting personal information about senators during Brett Kavanaugh's testimony last week. Jackson Lee just wrapped up a press conference on all of this. ABC 13's Catherine Marchand is joining us with her big response. Catherine?
Well, the congresswoman says that Jackson Costco had only been an intern in her D.C. office for 38 days. As soon as she learned of this suspected behavior, she fired him. Court documents say that he posted personal information of five U.S. senators we're talking, cell phone numbers and home addresses on Wikipedia. Sheila Jackson Lee, though, says her office had nothing to do with this. In fact, she says she doesn't know how he got that information in the first place. Take a listen.
That's why this is criminal behavior. That's why the other senators and members of Congress would have no knowledge, just as I had no knowledge, that this was being exposed. This is a criminal behavior.
Live in downtown Houston, Catherine Marchand, 13 Eyewitness News.
All right, a report from Houston. That was about a year ago, but there's so much to this story. And basically, Senator Hassan, Maggie Hassan's aide, Jackson Costco, is in deep trouble. And you will remember very well the Kavanaugh hearing. Who of us could forget? But what you might not remember was that during that hearing, there was personal information placed on WikiLeaks about several Republican senators, Senator Graham, Senator Rand Paul, and others on the that were daring to question the chief witness against Brett Kavanaugh. Well, we know now who that what was happening, how that private information got out, and we know it because Luke Rosiak has done a great expose on this. Luke, again, is our guest this morning. He's an investigative reporter for the Daily Caller. We're going to switch to this story for the moment, Luke. So you tell the story. What did Jackson Costco actually do?
Well, he was an IT guy for Senator Hassan, and he started basically, he did something bad that Hassan refuses. First of all, she hired him when he was a felon. And so she gave all of her data over to the IT guy who, you know, she didn't run a background check on or whatever. And he's a pretty bad dude. And so he starts like taking home stationery, taking home all the materials he would need to impersonate her. And eventually he's fired for reasons that Hassan has refused to explain. She knew about something else that was bad that happened before all this. And long before, like 6 months before, didn't tell anyone, just kind of quietly asked him to resign. And so he's pretty mad at that point because he's been pushed out of the office. And so what he does is he colludes with another staffer who's still working there, and she gives him her key to get into the office. And so he goes in at night and implants spy devices into the USB ports of all the computers. And what those devices do is every single keystroke that's recorded, it sends it back to him. So he gets the passwords that way because he's seeing every email, every text you write on your computer, every password. So he gets those passwords and uses that to get more documents. And so he downloads every single file on the network drive. And he gets back with this woman. Her name is Samantha DeForest Davis, who's the conspirator, and gives him the key again. And he goes in at like 1 a.m. to the office, you know, takes all the files that he had collected. And he does this for a period of months. And so eventually the Kavanaugh hearings roll around, and he uses the data. Some of what he got was information about all senators of both parties, their addresses, cell phones. And so he's working, remember, he's been fired at this point from the Senate. Well, Sheila Jackson Lee, one of the, you know, great, great minds of Congress, truly very accomplished congressman.
He says tongue-in-cheek.
Picks him up. And, you know, he's like this 28-year-old who's rich. He's a millionaire. His dad is, you know, mega, mega millionaire. Built a building named after Dianne Feinstein's husband. Dianne Feinstein is the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, and that's kind of how he got his way into Congress. So he winds up, after he's fired, working for Jackson Lee. She doesn't do any background check or reference check on him either, apparently. And so he uses... he takes the data that he stole from Senator Hassan in the Senate, which is the private information of Republican senators. And then he goes to his office in the Congress with Jackson Lee, logs onto Wikipedia and uploads it all. And so that's when this kind of burst into the public view, is where the Democrats are going crazy, making all this stuff up about you know, about Kavanaugh, and he's just blatantly intimidating people for into voting against him. And so
exactly.
Rand Paul says, look, you know, there's got to be punishment for whoever uploaded this. And then he doxes Rand Paul. So he starts intimidating all the witnesses. You know, someone catches him in the act in Senator Housen's office, sneaking in at night, and he's busted. And so he emails her and says, look, I've got everything. I've got Senator's children's information. I've got every single text she ever wrote. If you tell anyone, I'm going to publish all that. So there's like multiple levels of witnesses that he's straight up blackmailing.
The senators particularly, I mean, even though we know that he has the information on all of them, he published information on Lindsey Graham, Orrin Hatch, Mike Lee, Mitch McConnell, and Rand Paul after Rand Paul said, you know, someone needs to go after this guy or this person. But here, you know what? Let's spell this out, Luke. Why is this so dangerous?
Well, I mean, so he was putting key loggers in the computers, which literally means it logs every time you press keys. Like, that is truly like spy level stuff. That is deeply mind boggling that level of infiltration could happen in the Congress. Right after this story we discussed a minute ago about those other hackers that I wrote the book about. Because at that time, they said, don't worry, we learned our lesson. And so the pattern here is Congress never learns. No matter how many times they go through these insane scandals fueled by their own incompetence, they never fix things. And so, you know, they hire this guy, he's a felon. They fire him quietly when they catch him, but he's rehired by another congressman, basically, there's two people in Hossen's office who are conspiring to completely ransack the office with every scrap of data in it. Hossen wasn't even going to say that there was two people working. I kind of found out this woman's name and revealed that woman's name. But it's pretty remarkable to have two members of Senator Hossen's office plotting against her and stealing all this very sensitive data that, you know, these people didn't have background checks. They had none of the basic security measures that you would assume a first world country would have.
Well, I'm not, would you say, fair to say, not just plotting against her, but against really the country, just betraying all of us. I mean, if we'd had, someone could have been killed. The Kavanaugh hearing was so tense, and there was so much tension in that room and so much potential violence that for them to leak the personal addresses and cell phones, information about their children, just so incredibly dangerous. And you give us a little more information in your article about who this Costco was. You've already said, but you said he was a Bernie Sanders supporter. His dad, again, as you said, is a millionaire with close ties to politicians, including Dianne Feinstein. He was the past head of the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce. And then the other person, Samantha DeForest Davis, what do we know about her?
She's a recent college graduate who went to sort of a far-left indoctrination college and came out just fueled by identity politics. She basically looks white, but she says she's half black, and her whole, you know, shtick has been like oppression of minorities. And so she, you know, and New Hampshire is, you know, something like 95% white, but, you know, she got into Congress with this shtick of like minorities on the press, blah, blah, blah. And then she turns around and just steals everything from her employer. And so you've got basically a white girl pretending to advocate for black power, and then you have this millionaire pretending to be a socialist, and they come together and just ransack a Democrat's office and use that data to threaten Republicans. So it really is just a bizarre tale, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And Luke, let me ask you another question, because in another private briefing, I heard probably around the time this broke, at least in D.C., that, and I actually have to be careful how I say this, that there was even more information obtained to other high level personnel that was potentially going to be leaked, and it was just so dangerous. And do you know if they actually got into, without even being specific, if they actually had personal information on other kinds of people in Washington to whom there would be great danger if it was leaked?
So you're talking about Jackson Costco, whether he got that data?
Yes. I'm talking about, do you know if they, did they stop at senators and congressmen, or did they have more?
I think they did. I mean, well, so the thing is, they got, like, all the, they got Social Security numbers of Senate staffers, they got government credit cards, they got constituent information, which if you're in New Hampshire and you reached out to your Senator Hossen for help, and maybe you shared your Social Security number or something, that was all hacked by this guy. And, you know, I don't know that she ever bothered to tell any of those constituents that their data was compromised. And then there's also employee information for people at the Senate. And then they got literally tens of thousands of emails. So anything, and Hossen is on the government, on the Homeland Security Committee. So anything involving that probably may have been exposed.
So what is the crime in a situation like this? I mean, what are they charged with? And I don't think even Samantha has not been charged, as I understand it, but Jackson Costco has. So what is the charge against him?
So he was charged with obstruction of justice, identity theft, witness intimidation. They loaded him up with charges pretty good. And so they put this skinny little millionaire white boy in the D.C. jail. And suddenly he's just completely frightened and he wants out desperately. And so he just starts singing like a canary, and his mommy comes in and says, look, we can hire the finest psychologists and doctors. He doesn't need to be in jail. We're going to pay for private supervision. And so they basically buy his way out of jail. And meanwhile, Feinstein, who's the original patron and really was the one plotting against Feinstein, who also brought Costco into Congress, you know, she's not, you know, there's not really any indication that she's pressing for severe charges against this guy. Congress is just kind of covering it up. And so ultimately they give him, he pleads guilty and he'll probably get like 3 years in jail. But, you know, he sold out his accomplice pretty quick. But the interesting thing there is that she hasn't been charged yet. I assume she will in the next month. But if she doesn't, then something sketchy is going on there.
Which will mean Luke Rosiak is going to have either another book or at least another article to write about this and this next scandal. Yeah, let's we just have a few minutes left in this segment. Luke, let's go back for a second, because I teased earlier that you had discovered some things about this FISA motion, which allowed the FBI to share U.S. citizens' information with foreign agencies, and that's part of why they were able to build such a strong fake case against the president. Could you just say a few words about that?
Sure. So the big picture here is that the plot against Donald Trump was mounted from Europe. Christopher Steele was, of course, British intelligence, but he was also working with the former head of MI5, Richard Dearlove, and then basically the FBI agents who were tailing George Papadopoulos were based out of Rome. The Italian intelligence was involved there. And basically, you know, they tailed them around Greece. It was all these countries where basically what it is we have these little thing called the U.S. Constitution in America that prevents our government from spying on us. But what they do is they get you overseas, have someone else spy on you, and then tell John Brennan or Clapper what they found. And so that's basically the gist of it is this was a EU-mounted operation to stop Trump, as bizarre as that sounds, and then they create this two-way communication between the CIA and the FBI in these foreign countries, have them do the dirty work, and they basically outsource it to people that don't need to abide by the U.S. Constitution.
Well, and they also then, it seemed, were able to make a firmer, more convincing case against the president because they folded in other countries as though this was a worldwide conspiracy, and all these reliable foreign intelligence sources were, you know, discovering these things too, so it must be true, when actually it was all orchestrated.
Yeah, I mean, their excuse for why they started this investigation was, it wasn't the dossier, which was created by a British intel officer, it was the Australian ambassador heard something in a bar about George Papadopoulos and then immediately marked to the FBI. So it's like all these countries now are really playing a key role here, and Trump could have put a stop to a lot of this about a year ago. There was a big push from conservatives who said, look, we're wasting so much time on this. Just declassify everything. Like, stop with the secrecy. Trump has the ability to declassify it all, and Americans will learn the truth once and for all. And he said, I'm going to do it. And then within the next 2 days after that, he had a change of heart because people bullied him and said, sir, you can't harm our allies. England is going to be very mad if you do this. And so they gave him this line about like, oh, well, we have this special relationship with England, and so we can't anger them by releasing what exactly? I mean, whatever it is that England and Australia and Greece and Italy did here, they know that if Trump finds out what it was, he's going to be really mad. And so they've turned it against him into this, oh, well, there's sensitivity on the international stage. But, the secrecy has been justified by this excuse of we don't want to anger our allies.
Absolutely. And it's just amazing how Europe and our so-called allies, I think we can understand it when we see how the left operates here. They have a different viewpoint than the American people. And so it is overseas. All the international leftists seem to be a big cabal. And they work together to undermine this duly elected president. He was an affront to them, embarrassing. He was conservative on all of these issues. And, they just didn't want him to have the power that he has. And so they work together to undermine him. And that's basically the story. Luke Rosiak is my guest. But when we come back, corruption in Congress, more of it. We'll talk about that when we return. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Capitol Hill has been swept into a national moment of reckoning about the frequency and pain of sexual harassment. Here are three things you need to know. Number one. This is a bipartisan problem. The two most recent cases of sitting members of Congress caught up in sexual misconduct allegations are Congressman John Conyers of Michigan, who in 2015 settled a complaint filed by a former aide, and Senator Al Franken, who has apologized after accusations of unwanted touching by four women. But Roy Moore, the Republicans' Alabama Senate candidate, is facing multiple accusations of sexual assault from underage women. Senior members of both parties know that this is a problem that hits them equally. Number two, it's far from clear that the GOP Congress will take up broader legislation that would reform the current process for handling sexual harassment complaints on the Hill. Congresswoman Jackie Speier and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand have written a proposal to change the system, but Gillibrand's bill has yet to attract a single Republican sponsor, and Speier's only has a handful of GOP backers. Number three, the so-called slush fund is only part of the story. You've heard a lot about the $17 million paid out since 1997 to settle cases brought before the Office of Compliance, the Hill's workplace misconduct adjudicators. But that money covers many different types of disputes besides sexual harassment, and some sexual harassment settlements, like the one Conyers reached, aren't counted because they were paid using office budgets, not by the Office of Compliance. But either way, taxpayers are still on the hook for these settlements.
That was a report from Politico, and you remember when that broke? All of this money spent to settle allegations of sexual misconduct toward congressmen. I believe this was just—I don't know if it was just the House. Luke will tell us in just a second. And we expected that information would be released, didn't we? But it never was. The names—some of the sketchy details were released, but the names were never released. Luke has just written, Luke Rosiak, our guest with the Daily Caller, has just written an article that's an expose, not just on this, not just on the sexual allegations, but how Congress circles the wagons and protects its own. It's in part the reason why we have the Congress we have. They help each other get reelected. They cover for each other. And it really, truly is a nonpartisan endeavor. And it is scandalous in so many ways. So, Luke, let's talk about this. I guess since we started with that clip from Politico, let's talk about the, let's not talk about that. Let's approach it the way you have in your article here. You talk about the average age in Congress. Let's start there. Why is it that we have so many very, very old people serving in Congress?
Yeah, so it's kind of like once you're in Congress, you're in, and you're not going anywhere. And they set up this situation where they get us all talking about Republicans versus Democrats when that's not what it is. The whole thing is kind of a smokescreen. What it really is insiders versus outsiders. And once they're in, they have this kind of bipartisan truce, just like what you saw in the sexual harassment clip that just played. where it's the insiders protecting each other. It's kind of like in the Cold War, the mutually assured destruction. We won't nuke you because if we do, you're going to nuke us. And so that's kind of the pact that they have, is they don't expose ethical misconduct on each other in Congress because they know they're all up to no good. And it's better just to protect each other. And so, basically there's a variety of factors which have led to, if you look at the leadership of the House, they're all like in their high 70s. Pelosi, Jim Clyburn, they're all 78 or 79 years old. And so you have this situation where campaign finance, it's so expensive to run now, where once you're in, the special interest they give, and people say, oh, PAC money and special interest money, it must benefit Republicans. It's like oil companies or whatever. That's not what it is. The special interest money doesn't help Republicans over Democrats. It helps incumbents over outsiders, because what they want to do is give to the people who are on the committee, so we're in charge. And so it's, again, once you're in, you're in. And then you have the fact that basically so many districts aren't competitive anymore because of the increasing partisanship of America. So you have a lot of people that are living in very liberal areas or very conservative areas, and it's basically one-party rule, which is kind of how corruption takes root.
Luke, let me just jump in there. There's another factor also in that incumbents, I think the reason they're having such success in these primaries, I know for a fact, at least on the Republican side, is because Republicans out of Washington, Republican leadership, never used to get involved in local races. They would let the people choose the candidate they wanted to represent from their party. And then once that person was the candidate, that's when the national offices would jump in. So right now we have sort of a corrupt process in that, at least in the House and the Senate, they spend their campaign funds, war chests, they pick the candidate for the country. They pick the candidate for your district, and they pour tons of money into that person to get that incumbent that they've worked with and they know will compromise with them, will wink, wink, nod, cooperate with them to do whatever they want. And I'm sure the Democrats do the same thing. They don't want outsiders, and that's why the incumbents keep winning those primaries also. Sorry to interrupt your narrative, but I know you know that.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I mean, the party always goes for the incumbent. And so between the fact that you're living in a conservative area, you know the Republican's going to win. Whoever wins the Republican primary, that's who's going to be the congressman. Well, the party is always going to put the money behind the Republican who's already in office. So there's only like four primary challengers that won last year, and the most famous one is, Alexandria Cortez. But then they turn around, and when they get in trouble, and she's had ethics complaints filed against her, and, Charlie Rangel before her, and any number of very long list of congressmen, they get in trouble now, and what do? If they're Democrats, they say, oh, this is just a plot by the Republicans. They're out to get me. And it's like, what are you talking about? Your district is 90% Democrat. If you get booted out of the office for corruption, you're just going to be replaced by another Democrat. So there's actually partisanship has very little to do with most of what goes on with any of this stuff. And it's just a smokescreen that's used to manipulate Americans.
Yes.
Because that's what they do. This other Republicans have, then they rally to, Alexandria Cortez's side, and everyone kind of goes to their assigned trenches. And what you don't realize is this is just like a couple hundred entrenched insiders who are protecting their own job security at the expense of America. It's got nothing to do with the party. It's got nothing to do with policy. That's what it is. It's protecting the people who are in power.
Let's talk about this sexual harassment issue that came up. And actually, Luke, you'll have to remind me, how did that come up a couple of years ago? What was the catalyst for that?
Well, Mike Cernovich got documents showing that John Conyers had paid off like tens of thousands of dollars to cover up, the fact that he was sexually harassing staffers. And he knew that if Mike Cernovich had broke the story, they would ignore it, and they would tell it's just a Republican. He's out to get this congressman, plus Conyers is black. Maybe Mike Cernovich is racist. And they would dismiss it with all that identity politics cynicism that's used to, shield bad people from culpability for their actions. And so he was pretty smart. He gave it to BuzzFeed, and BuzzFeed broke the story, and they couldn't really use that against the liberal publication. And so Congress says, we're shocked. We had no idea that you could use taxpayer money to pay off sexual harassment victims. But that was a lie. They set up this whole system that was a specific fund designed to do just that. And so there was this kind of shocked reaction, which was completely absurd. There were people in Congress whose job it was to sign off on all these settlements, and there had been many of them over the years. But even then, they kind of, as you mentioned in the lead into the segment, they released some statistics, but they were not remotely comprehensive, and they obviously knew that these statistics were essentially fake. And, you know, the only way you could explain, you know, it's either incompetence or it's lying, the way that they tried to downplay this problem. And at the end of the day, they never released the names of the people who were paying people off on this. But, you know, it kind of goes deeper than that. The whole system, the employment lawyers and the HR people in Congress were agreeing to break the rules to protect congressmen. And so you realize, I mean, this is all by design. I mean, kind of decades in advance, they figured out if you could create all these offices and offload responsibility onto them, but then to make sure that those offices were corrupt, you can protect yourself and just kind of punt to someone else. And the Ethics Committee is the same way. The Ethics Committee is run by Congress. And so you're basically not going to want to, you know, punish or be too aggressive to your peer, who may be from the same state or maybe something you want to get their vote on soon. And so you realize that the Ethics Committee, when you look at the statistics, ignores the vast majority of the wrongdoing that they uncover, and they basically take no action against their fellow members, no matter what.
The one weapon they are, I know you did, this is not part of what you covered, but the one way the Ethics Committee, though, can punish their members, especially conservatives, I can't think of an exception to this, is that they put them under investigation. And they have to, like Devin Nunes, and have to sort of pull away from their duties while they're under investigation, even though they're not investigating them. And they can keep them under what I think Kathy McMorris Rodgers has been, you know, under ethics investigation, what, for 6 years or something like that?
Yeah, so you could look at it one of two ways. Either they're trying to just keep this cloud hanging over their head for a long time, or they're trying to avoid drawing a conclusion. Yeah, and I think, you know, not with Devin Nunes. I don't think Devin Nunes did anything. I think Kathy McMorris Rodgers probably did do something. And they were just basically, there's no way to justify taking 5 years to figure out whether she used taxpayer money to help her campaign or not. Like, she either did it or didn't. You know, it doesn't take 5 years to figure that out. Mm-hmm. And if she did it, then by delaying and delaying and delaying, it lets her go through elections and things like that. So a lot of times they just kind of drag it on so you can win elections and maybe you'll retire on your own.
So, Luke, the House Ethics Committee, we probably have heard of that more often, but there are other committees involved in this stuff. What the Committee on House Administration, I don't understand all of this, but you say, I'm going to have you fill in the blanks here. I'm going to name names because I think it's important. The leader of that committee on the Democratic side, Representative Bob Brady of Pennsylvania, and in the last Congress on the Republican side, Greg Harper of Mississippi. What is it that they were doing that was covering for members of Congress?
So basically, anytime something wrong happens in the House, like the Imran Awan case that we talked about, the hacking and the stealing that those guys were doing, those two congressmen you mentioned, they knew all of it for years, and they didn't tell anyone, and they misled about it, and they covered for it. And same thing with, you know, basically all the cases that we've dealt with where you're talking about HR or IT or, you know, these are the people who are in charge of behind the scenes in Congress. And so, you know, they were the ones who were approving all of these sexual harassment, settlements. And, you know, they won't even say that they ever denied a single one. It just seems like they were rubber stamping it. Both of those guys are out of office now, but some of their staff remain. And, you know, it's basically just that's the back office of Congress that exists to protect each other. I want to make two points just to highlight the fact that this is this idea that once you get into Congress, you stay in, and that's kind of damaging to America, right? I mean, you think about the founders, they had this idea of the citizen legislature, where you go in and, you know, maybe you're a farmer or whatever, and you take a couple of years off from your job, and you go to Congress, and then you come back, and you resume your normal life. And that's not what we have anymore. I mean, even 100 years ago, it was very uncommon to have someone in Congress for 20 years. And now we have, like, 150 sitting lawmakers have been in Congress for multiple decades. They don't even remember what it's like to be a normal American. It's kind of like Hillary Clinton hasn't driven a car in 40 years or whatever, like, how can these people possibly represent us? And the two places that you see it the most are wherever you see ideological conformity. So the two great examples are inner cities, because they're just basically complete mindless Democrats, or, you know, you have the kind of deep red states where, same thing, I mean, there's not really a robust Democratic Party that can win in these elections, and so you have cases like Strom Thurmond, who was like, you know, he won as a Republican, and he stayed in until he was like, what, over 100 years old,
yeah,
from like 1956 until 2003. And it's just kind of silly that this idea that out of everyone in the whole state, they couldn't find anyone else. Another example is, you know, Conyers in Detroit, John Conyers, and then also John Dingell. So both of these people are from Detroit. The entire time from 1950, when Detroit is the richest city in the country, to, you know, a few years ago when it's just basically a symbol of urban decay. And they just keep reelecting these guys, even though the city's going down the tube.
Yes, they do. And that's why, much of the reason why we're in the mess we're in. Luke has just been doing some great reporting on this. So what we're going to do is we're going to put every piece that we've discussed this morning on our Facebook page, because there's a lot more information that we didn't get to. And you can read this and share it. And, you know, God willing, we can do something about this. Take back our country, take back our democracy, our Republican democracy. I'd like to do that. Luke Rosiak, investigative reporter for Daily Caller. Luke, thank you so much for your great reporting. You do what journalists should be doing, and it's so necessary to keep our country free. Thank you so much. Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.